There we go. Hopefully that's all working. Technical error last week, so it didn't record the talk, but hopefully today it will. Well, what an educated and a well-read bunch we all are here today. I suspect that if I asked you to, you could all quote back to me the German philosopher. You're getting nervous, aren't you? The German philosopher Friedrich Wilhelm Nietzsche. You could, couldn't you? Well, do you know what Nietzsche famously said? God is dead. God is dead. That's Nietzsche's famous. If you don't know anything else about Nietzsche, Nietzsche said God is dead, and it still sounds a shocking claim to make, which is why we kind of know it. It sort of slipped into popular culture, but it wasn't actually a new idea. Today we're going to be looking at Psalm 53. Which reveals that Nietzsche wasn't the first person to imagine a universe devoid of our sovereign God. Psalm 53 verse 1 is where the psalmist declares, "The fool says in his heart, there is no God." In other words, God is of no relevance to us now. God doesn't exist. God is dead. And thinking that there's no God, that God is nothing more than, an old man who's dead and buried, it might sound tempting. Think of the freedom you'd have if there was no God. God's all very restrictive, isn't it? That's what the world likes to tell us. But Psalm 53 reveals that it's foolishness. It's not stupidity, it's not ignorance. It's foolishness, it's a moral deficiency that will lead to wickedness. See, Nietzsche's assertion that there was no God led him to imagine a world where God's restraints, as he saw it, had been removed. And he concluded that the Christian God had promoted a sense of pity. And that pity, on the whole, he thought, thwarts the law of selection. What did he mean by that? Well, this is what Nietzsche meant. He believed that in nature, the fittest do survive. So, you watch your David Attenborough film, and we all kind of, we're all there, aren't we? We're rooting for the little innocent fluffy animal that's kind of running across being chased by the snakes or whatever it is. And we're kind of rooting for the little fluffy animal. But we know that really in nature, it's those fittest animals that survive. And that's what Nietzsche argued. He argued, if in nature the fittest do survive, then the fittest should survive, including humanity. So he concluded, and these are his words, "The weak and ill-constituted shall perish, and one shall help them do so." Does that sound a little bit concerning? Nietzsche himself wasn't an evil man, but his ideas were adopted and popularized and repurposed by Hitler and the Nazis. So when we watch a movie like Schindler's List and we think, how could those soldiers willingly and knowingly, without any sense of kind of it being wrong, put those men and those women and those children onto trains going to concentration camps and gas chambers? How could they do it without any sense of guilt and shame? The answer becomes obvious. They grew up and they were brought up in a world filled with Nietzsche's teaching. They felt no guilt or shame because they behaved in a way that they did, honestly believing that no one was ever going to call them to account. Not in this world and not in the next. In their hearts they'd said, there is no God because God is dead, and so we can do as we please. And the psalmist hits the nail on the head. He says, these people are corrupt and their ways are vile. There is no one who does good. But when we hear that verse, that should start to ring some little salutary bells for us as well, shouldn't it? Because it's easy to point the finger at the people like the Nazis in the 30s and the 40s, or at groups that we view as evil today. But David, the psalmist, says, no one does good. And when we read that, that very much should remind us of Paul writing to the Romans in the New Testament. Paul says, what shall we conclude then? Do we have any advantage? No, not at all, for we've already made the charge that Jews and Gentiles alike are all under the power of sin. As it is written, there is no one righteous, not even one. There is no one who understands. There is no one who seeks God. All have turned away. They have together become worthless. There is no one who does good. Not even one. So, Paul is quoting David from the Psalms. The New Testament draws us back to Psalm 53 and actually Psalm 14 as well. Now, the thing is, Psalm 15, Psalm 14, very much connected. I don't know if you've ever sort of heard a song, you know, by a band, and they've had a big hit, and then they release their follow-up single, and you go, I like it, but it's pretty much the same as the big hit. And usually they can become one-hit wonders, don't they? Now, the thing is, the Psalms are not immune from that. Psalm 53 is pretty much Psalm 14, repeated word for word. So, you know, if you're reading through the Psalms and you come to Psalm 53 and you think, hang on, I'm sure I've done this one, you have. Because it is almost word for word, Psalm 14. God really is trying to drive home the point to us, to convict us of our sin. It's not that kind of, you know, David needed a bit of a filler. Do you remember when you used to buy 12-inch albums? And there'd always be that track that was a filler. I've kind of, through Spotify, I've kind of gone back and listened to some of those 80s albums that I always wanted but couldn't afford at the time. And you find yourself kind of going, the singles are great, but there's some real, you know, stinkers of fillers in there. Psalm 53 isn't a filler. God's driving home to us the point that actually we need to be convicted of our sins. We need to recognise it. It's something that's there for us all. It's not something we like to think about, because it's easy for us to point the finger at other people and go, well, they do that, don't they? They're not the real deal. We see the fault in others and not in ourselves. And that's what Jesus was doing in our gospel reading. You know, it's a great passage that. It sounds very kind of mournful. I can imagine it. It's a little bit like stand-up comedy. Because I can imagine that there's the teachers of the law and the Pharisees, and they're seething as they hear this. Because Jesus is basically saying, you guys look really good, but actually, you're not the real deal. And meanwhile, there's kind of a whole load of people laughing their heads off. Because Jesus says to them, look, I want you to imagine, you get the kids to do the washing up. So kids, did you ever do the washing up at home? Does mum or dad ever ask you to do the washing? Do you do it sometimes? Occasionally, sometimes. You like to do it. But the thing is, can you imagine, right, if you very carefully washed up all the outside of a nice cup, but then inside you left it all dirty and then it kind of went in the cupboard and it went a bit green and furry. Yeah, actually, that's what teenagers do, isn't it, really? They don't even wash the outside. But anyway, there you go. That wouldn't be any good, would it? When you came to have a cup of tea or something like that, you wouldn't want to use that cup, would you? Jesus said, you teachers of the law and you Pharisees, he said, you're like that. You look all good on the outside, but on the inside you're all nasty and horrible. But imagine, you made a big pan of soup. Do you like soup?
Yeah.
What's your favourite soup?
Tomato and pasta.
Tomato and pasta? Whoa! Fantastic. Okay, so you had a big bowl of tomato and pasta soup, okay, and it's a nice sort of summer's day. I don't know why you'd be having soup on a summer's day, but anyway, there you go, go with me. And a little fly went in there, okay, and your mum got a little teaspoon and just kind of went, it'll be alright, and got the fly up and chucked it out like that. And then she gets a big ladle and she ladles it into your bowl, and as she goes there's a big plop, and then you can see this rat floating around in your bowl. Would you still want to eat that?
No.
Jesus said, you teachers of the law and you Pharisees, said you strain, he actually was even worse, he said, you strain out a gnat, a little fly, and you leave a camel. Can you imagine there being a camel in your soup bowl? Wowee. You know, you wouldn't want that, certainly. And Jesus, so there's all these, I can imagine there's all these people laughing their heads off at Jesus telling these things. And the teachers of the law and the Pharisees kind of just looking daggers at him, you see. But the point he's making is that actually what the teachers of the law and the Pharisees were doing, they were looking like they were really good people, but actually inside, they weren't. They were like a cup that was clean outside, mouldy on the inside. They were like someone that strained out the little thing, the little problem, but left the big problem there. See, we might not all be evil like the Nazis were, but all of us are like Nietzsche at some time. We're all foolish. We live or act or we speak as if God is dead. All of us do things and we behave as if there's no consequences for what we do or say or think. For all have sinned and fall short of the glory of God, concludes Paul in Romans chapter 3, verse 23. But God is very much alive. Verse 4 of Psalm 53, God himself says, do all these evildoers know nothing? They know nothing? I'm very much alive. I do exist. I am real. I hear. I see. How foolish we are to deceive ourselves that God isn't there, or that he knows nothing of what we say or do. He's very observant. They devour my people as though eating bread, and they never call on God, declares the Lord. He sees, he knows what these evil people are doing. So why are we all prone to godlessness? Because at some level, at some time, we believe that this is a godless world. We put our beliefs to one side. We believe the lie that actually God isn't real. And we just crack on with everyday life without God. And that no one will actually call us to account for what we say or we do or we think. Matthew Henry in his commentary puts it like this. He said, men's bad practices flow from their bad principles. Men's bad practices flow from their bad principles. And in these days of equality, so do women's. As God condemns that attitude, we see that he despises those who act as if he's dead, and he draws our attention to the fact that living as if there was no God does us no good. It's just really pointless. I don't know, I'm like you, I've you know, been targeted for scams and things like that. I mean, well, most of us have, haven't we? We get, I'm amazed how many Nigerian princes get hold of my email account and want to transfer $1 million to my account. It's amazing. I just never get the time to do it. And we get all those messages, don't we? And those phone calls and those texts and about there being a parcel and we've got to pay some money to have it delivered. And it works on that principle that we panic and we just do it. Maybe you've had your home broken into or attempted break-ins. Maybe you've had a vehicle stolen or something like that. And there are people trying to do those things all the time. I always check through my credit card bill after someone tried to put their mortgage payment on my credit card once. So, we're always got to be on vigilant. But do you know what? I sometimes think about these things, and these people who do these things, and the technology they use and the time they do. And at the moment, I kind of almost get a phone call every day from someone through some energy trust, which is a fraudulent thing. And the effort and the time and the energy and the expense that these people put into trying to steal money. And I find myself thinking, I thought you were doing this so that you didn't have to work. I always assumed people did these sorts of things, committed these sorts of crimes, so they didn't have to do a 9-to-5 job. But actually, to me, it feels as if they're working a lot harder than a lot of people who do 9-to-5 jobs. And there's an added factor, isn't there? There's an added factor, the fear that you're going to get caught. And David makes that point in verse 5. They are overwhelmed with dread where there was nothing to dread. See, I don't know about you, but I'm not anxious about the police breaking down my door at 4 a.m. in the morning. But I guess if you're kind of doing dodgy things, there's always that little thought at the back of your mind as you go to bed at night. Those of us who are not frustrating the plans of the poor, as Psalm 14 puts it, or devouring God's people as if it was as normal as eating bread, as Psalm 53 and 14 describe those who have no fear of God. We don't have that fear when we go to bed. But if you're behaving wickedly, then there's overwhelming dread where there was nothing to dread. So, is there any good news? Well, yes. God might despise our attitude when we live as if he were dead, but he loves us when we live in acknowledgement that he is the ever-living God. And we know that it's not a big step to go from denying God to acknowledging God. Verses 5 and 6 of Psalm 14, which is the parallel psalm, remind us that God is present in the company of the righteous and the Lord is their refuge. And then at the end of Psalms 53 and Psalm 14, excuse me, we're reminded of our hope. Oh, that salvation for Israel would come out of Zion. When God restores his people, let Jacob rejoice and Israel be glad. The psalmist's hope is in Zion. where the temple was, where the Holy of Holies, where God dwelt amongst his people. That is where salvation will come from, he says. And of course, as Jesus died at the hands of morally deficient men who denied that he was God amongst them, who said, Jesus, you are no God. You are just a man. The temple curtain which separated humanity from God would be torn in two from top to bottom by God himself, so that the Lord would come and restore his people by the death and the resurrection of Jesus, bringing joy and celebration. So as we approach Lent and the road to Easter, this psalm reminds us that God is very much alive and that he comes to save those who put their trust in him. Salvation and restoration for God's people comes from the living God, because he sees us and he sees our need. And he will not allow evil and wickedness to ultimately triumph over those who put their hope and their trust in him. The evildoers might frustrate the plans of the poor, but the Lord is their refuge and he will frustrate the plans of the wicked. Who is it that Jesus says will inherit the earth? It's not the arrogant and the proud, is it? It's the meek. So, if Proverbs chapter 1 verse 7 tells us that the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom, Psalms 53 and Psalm 14 show us the other side of the coin. Okay, the beginning, the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom, but the rejection of God is the beginning of folly, and it is the path to moral corruption. So let's not have that side of the coin. Let's flip it back over, and let's know that the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. See, Nietzsche might have declared that God is dead, but 8 years after he made that declaration, he was in his grave forever. But the eternal living God remains on his glorious throne. Even death for him couldn't keep him in the tomb. Thine be the glory, risen, conquering Son. Endless is thy victory. You see, saying that there's no God doesn't make you stupid. But allowing that untruth to make you morally deficient is foolishness beyond belief, literally. We need to find our joy and our gladness in the firm hope that Jesus is alive. So we should approach Easter in the confident knowledge that the grave could not hold him and that death could not conquer the Lord of life. The fool says in his heart, there is no God. But salvation for God's people has come out of Zion. God has restored his people. So let God's children rejoice and let God's nation be glad. Amen.